Good morning, and Tom. It's hot and cold Saturday morning. You knew that. You knew that. You're here for that reason. Zuma, zuma, zoopaloo. It just happens. It just comes out, and there's no stopping it. So I usually don't speak it out loud, although I've had the occasion. I will speak these things out loud in the shop and realize there is a customer. I'm sure that's really good. That's what you call business development right there. So anyway, good morning. So we're still moving, okay? I have a friend who is keeping track. You've been moving for 2 months? No, I've been moving for about 3 months. But we are, and we can't officially move till we've been inspected by the state, and that hasn't happened yet. So I'm finding a bit of a respite here where I'm catching my breath a little bit, which is good. And so I think to have some fun, I'm finally going to get the photovoltaic system together and get that in place. I'm starting to run down on building shelves, which is good. I had put together a sort of a workstation for hybrid batteries and regular batteries, which came in very handy because we've just been out straight with hybrid batteries. And I had one the other day. Actually, it was one of my vehicles that needed what I thought was a battery rebuild, and it actually needed a wiring harness from a battery. And this is why I don't throw stuff out. You know that. If you do stuff, you do any kind of mechanical work, you know you don't throw stuff out for just that reason, when you need that thing, which is not an excuse just to hoard, but then again, it kind of is, isn't it? So, but I have been, I have paid the disposal company more money than I want to think about lately as I dispatch things that don't need to be with me. So I had a interesting design project in the new building. I had a plan. We've got another workbench that I put together months ago. And I thought, well, you know, above this workbench, it's on a gable end. I've got plenty of ceiling height. I'm going to build a big shelf over it, you know, 8 feet off the floor, where I could put big things, maybe car seats or whatever, stuff that's relatively light and could be out of the way. And, you know, as we were taking apart benches in other parts of the building, we had some workbenches that were 32 inches wide by the panels were 32 inches wide, which was the width of the bench, and we did it in 4 foot increments, so we could take a 4x8 sheet of OSB, cut it into three pieces, and I've got 12 feet of counter space. So I built this shelf, and put a cleat against the wall, 2x4x16, and then between two uprights, I put another 2x4x16, spanning 16 feet. So, of course, you can't span 16 feet unsupported, and I knew that. So I was noodling in my head different ways that I would want to build some kind of a truss to make this structural enough so it didn't sag or break. And it was, you know, just kind of casually thinking about it while I'm going around going zooma, zooma, bookaloo in my head. And it came to me one evening last week that all I need to do is build an I-beam. And so, you know, 2x4 is 3.5 inches thick. Obviously, it cannot span 16 feet. It can. It did. But, you know, it's going to sag. So what I did was very simple, because I have extra 2x4x16s, took another 2x4x16, and I've got cutoffs of OSB that happen to be 1 foot wide. So I screwed, and you have to visualize this, which I know is a little tricky, but took the two, these were 8 foot pieces, 1 foot wide. I screwed it to the to a 2x4x16 that would be standing on edge, and screw the OSB to the bottom, excuse me, put the 2x4 at the bottom of the 1 foot width and screwed it in so it's standing upright. So you've got an upright 2x4, you got a piece of OSB sticking up 1 foot with the 2x4 on one end and nothing on the other end. You then lift it up into place, screw it onto the 2x4 that's in place, we create an I-beam. So the 2x4s are the top and bottom cord, if you will, of an I-beam, and then the web is the OSB that's, you know, basically a foot thick. and stiffened everything right up and very structural. So, okay. So I'd say, okay, Tom, good move. So I put together the, I'm going to put together the rest of the shelf. So I've got these little joists coming out that are 30-some inches wide. I'm going to put the OSB on top. So I get started. I've got enough OSB already pre-cut, 32 inches. This is simple. Tom, it's so simple. Oh, God. So I'm screwing the joists in place every 24 inches. Again, it's not going to be real loaded heavy, and it's only spanning 32 inches. So every 24 inches, I've got a joist. So, okay, let's keep this simple. Minimal measuring. So I do the end piece. That's easy. Screw it in place. It's going to be measure over 24 inches on center, one in the center. I come to the other edge of the piece of OSB. I've got the OSB in place already. I just center the final 2x4 on the edge of the OSB so the next piece of OSB can also be on that. And I'll work my way across. I only have to measure for that center piece 2 feet over. If this is making sense, you're doing really good. So I did this. I'm going along, and I'm like, the OSB is not quite lining up on the wall. There's a gap, and I'm thinking, well, maybe the wall's a little cockeyed. Maybe I didn't do something right. So I get all done, and I'm spanning 16 feet now, and I get up on it. I'm walking around on it. It's very strong. And I look down, and if you have used OSB, you know they have lines on it that approximate different dimensions for you. So you, if you're cutting real crude, you can use that or anyway. So I'm looking at the lines as I'm walking across, and I notice something is at a major angle. And one of the second piece I put in, the edge was not square. And it was not square just enough so it wasn't noticeable. But it was unsquare enough that I couldn't leave it. So I, and it was time to go home. It was getting late anyway. And I obviously had missed it for probably being a long day. But here's the thing. The saving grace, this is the reason Tom and maybe you should use screws when you put projects together, is because it took me about 15 minutes to take the whole thing apart, put it back together with a proper square piece of wood, of OSB, and all is right with the world. It looks good. It does. It really does. So anyway, I tell you what, we're going to take a break here. It is 8:16. The Voice of Maine is Hot and Cold. You knew all that. We'll be right back. Mr. Otis Redding, Saturday Morning. We don't hear that song enough, do we? Come on, shake a little bit. Loop de loop. Okay. God, I love that song. What a great song, huh? Oh, my goodness. It's Saturday Morning. It's Hot and Cold. Good morning again. It's 23 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock. And a couple of things in the news are noteworthy. Speaking of shaking, there's a segue here that I came across this. It was in the New York Post, a bastion of journalism. But actually, it was from The Sun in the UK. So I guess that's a lot of credence. Angry rage can be a sign of serious illness. So I have to read this article because, you know, I get in the car sometimes and I find myself at times raving at inane opportunities that other drivers might take. I admit to that. So I'm thinking, okay, what kind of serious illness could I have? Having an angry rage. Oh, my goodness. So the angry rage. For people from, I think, 50 to 79, it doesn't mean anything. If you're over 80 and you're having an angry rage in the car, you could be really sick. So I love it. Talk about like clickbait, you know, get you to read an article that means nothing. I guess it means something if you're over 80 and you're getting really upset in the car or getting upset in general, which would kind of make sense. So while we're at it, another New York Post article. Excuse me. This was in a learned journal, actually. Ancient humans used to eat other ancient humans because they were, as they put it, low-cost food. You can't make that up. I mean, of all the ways to describe it, they were easy to, you know, you get Smiley over there. He doesn't run as fast. We'll eat him today. So I guess it's a good thing we're not Neanderthals, at least most of us. Our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. We got a text line, 601-207-4478, and that's big stuff there. We sold our forklift yesterday, which is not a big deal because we couldn't use it where we were moving to, but it means also I have to probably replace the forklift with something that runs on gravel, which means it's probably going to be more expensive. I either have to get a double-tired forklift, you know, two double tires in the front to be able to drive over gravel, or a tractor, which would be more expensive, or a payloader or something, a front-end loader. So the good news is I get to shop for something. The bad news is I don't have enough money to make that deal work, but we'll see. That's that'll be good. And the phones have commenced to ringing on Saturday morning, so let's go to the phone on line two. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Yes, good morning, Tom.
Hey.
My name is Jack. I have some Prius hybrid issues that I'd like to discuss.
Sure, go ahead.
I have a 2007 Prius hybrid. Mm-hmm. It would just quit, and the triangle light of death would come on. It would skip and buck and pull over.
Yep.
I finally took it to a dealership. They diagnosed it and said that I had a battery that was bad.
Yep.
I purchased a reconditioned battery. I had them come out and put it in.
Mm-hmm.
Seemed to work fine for a few days, and then it went back to the same thing.
Ooh.
I drive along. My light comes on. It bucks. It skips. It pops. I got to pull over. I wait a little bit. I can drive it again for about a mile. It does the same thing. I got a couple of codes, a P0118 coolant temperature sensor circuit that's been there for 4 years. It comes and goes.
Mm-hmm.
I did put in a control valve, water control valve, a new one of those.
Yeah.
And also getting a code of a P3190, which says something about the OBD2 system burned out, maybe MIO lamp or faulty catalytic converter or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I saw a quick code of a 9141. My problem is I don't know what to do, or I don't know where to go to have somebody look at it and diagnose it other than the dealership, and they just kill you with prices.
What is how many miles on this?
140, 150, something like that, 1,000.
It should be scanned again with a dealer computer. We have one. If you wanted to get it to us, we could go over it. Two thoughts. One is you got a bad battery, which seems, is this a remanufactured or a Toyota battery?
Yeah, no, remanufactured, but they came out. The guy drove 12 hours, came back out, and rescanned, redid everything again. He says, the battery put in is fine.
Okay.
He says, it's not the battery.
Okay.
You have other issues.
Okay, I'll try. We'll leave him for that, but I would obviously want to scan it again.
Right.
But you're not getting a code for a battery, so that's good news. I'm suspecting you need a catalytic converter. That's a spit in the dark guess. What you're telling me, if the catalytic converter is plugged up, you would get that kind of problem. And I had one in once that was doing that, and we finally got it to run, and it was blowing by the exhaust donut at the exhaust manifold. And so I took it in for a repair, and we found that the cat was plugged up. And I've subsequently...
Where can I take this for you to bring it to you to get it scanned and find out what my issues are?
You can get it to me at our place of business. We're 420 presently, for at least another week probably, 423 East Main Street in Searsport.
It's 420...
Three, 423. Yeah. East Main Street, which is Route 1.
Okay.
Where are you located?
Orrington.
Oh, okay. So you're not too far away.
No.
Well, it's nice somebody came out to do the replacement for you. If you have AAA, you get it towed down. If you're up for an adventure,
If I let it sit, clear all the codes out. The other day I went to Eastport and back, and it was fine.
Oh, wow.
I went in town, and then it caused the issue again.
Okay.
So I can get it down, or I can get it towed down.
Okay.
The other.
All right. Yeah. we can have a look at it, see what's going on, and go from there.
Okay, very good, Tom.
Okay.
Thank you kindly.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Bye.
Interesting, bye-bye. Interesting problem. Hey, we could take another break. It is 8:30 straight up right now, so let's do this. Let's go here, do that, hit the button, and we can, there we go. A little bit of Chet Atkins and Jerry Reed on Saturday morning. It's hot and cold Saturday morning, 8:30 straight up. We'll be back in just a minute. Stay with us. Okay, we're back. We're back. It's 8:35. It's hot and cold Saturday morning. Good morning again. I'm Tom. I just want to tell you about my friend Alan over at General Appliance and Brewer. If you're looking for appliance parts or service, he is the man. He is the guy. And he is available right there on Center Street, open 9 to 4 Monday through Friday. Phone number is 989-4341. And if you're looking for appliance parts or service, you want to give him a call. If you live in Orrington, as my previous caller did, you might want to consider voting for him for selectman. He's running for selectman in Orrington. Go figure, huh? Small world we live in. So that's 989-4341, number to call. Okay. Let's see. What else? I recycled. We had a whole bunch of computers we had been working with and selling online for a while. We had a whole bunch of stuff come in, and we recycled. Oh God, we must have recycled 500 pounds of computer parts. You know, talking about cleaning up stuff. And just in case you are out there in radio land, and you have computer parts, computer memory chips are worth about $17 a pound. Now, they don't weigh anything, but if you have a box of computer memory chips under the table somewhere, consider the fact that you've got some money in the bank sitting right there. We might have had a half pound, I'm guessing. I know we had a lot of heavy boxes of stuff, and I was just happy to have it move out, but we recycled it, and we're going to actually garner some income from it, which is even better. There's appreciable metals in those things that are of value. Our phone number again, 1-800-966-1039. The text line is 601-207-4478. While we have no calls, one of my sons had to go to Connecticut this week. And the company he works for rented him a car, and he drove down. He came back yesterday. And he, there's been times my wife has questioned the fact that maybe we should have settled somewhere else other than the state of Maine. I've never had that thought. She's wonders about it, especially as the winters, as we get a little bit older, you certainly feel the cold a little bit more. Maybe we would have made a better income being in another state. I haven't felt that. I love living here, and I'm not going anywhere else. And I've always had this concern that if I cross that river, Piscataway River, on that bridge, they ain't gonna let me back in. And I don't want to be left out. And we actually lived out of state for 2 months, a long time ago. If I was home and the Today Show was on, I'd be looking to see what the weather was in Maine. So I was in New Jersey at the time, and it was dreadful. Summertime in New Jersey was not a fun place to be. But 2 months and I was back. And anyway, the gist of the story is my son was driving back yesterday morning and sent to us an email, basically said the same thing that I say. He was relieved to get across that bridge and get back into the state of Maine. For all the issues we have, for all the people you think are jerks or adversarial or political opponents on one side or the other, neighbors who might be a pain in the neck, this is the state to be in. I have no qualms about that. I don't even want to go to New Hampshire. My Godfrey, you know what those people are like. Oh boy, there goes my New Hampshire audience. Good morning, you're on The Voice of Maine.
Good morning, Tom. This is Dave and Bradley.
Hi, Dave. How you doing?
Good. I replaced that component in my heat pump water heater last night,
yep.
And it seems to be working just right.
Okay, that was the control box I gave you?
Yeah.
Control module? Okay, good.
Well, I guess it's a
the black box
thing that's about 4 inches by 4 inches with a bunch of spade terminals.
Yep.
On it.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't remember everything anymore.
Yeah.
Good. And I gave you extras.
Anyway, there was a small wire connected to a big wire that went into the connector.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to pull that off, the wire came right out of the connector, and it looked like that little tiny wire that went to whatever, like a light or something. Well, that shouldn't make any difference, I suppose, but it didn't seem like it had a very good connection there.
Did you reconnect it?
I put a new spade terminal
on because
I pulled it out of the
other
one.
I think that, going from memory here, but I think that was a connection for a speed control for the blower, which was kind of irrelevant. It was a little electronic board it hooked to.
So it wouldn't be the cause of the problem.
No, that wasn't the cause of the problem. But you would make your blower not operate, and the heat pump would shut down prematurely. But it was different than the problem that you had. It's all coming back to me, Dave.
I caught it defrosting this morning when I went down, which alarmed me because I wasn't getting any heat out of it. And then I realized that by the different sound 10 minutes later that it had gone back in. I checked it, and I was putting out heat. So
good deal. Okay. Glad to hear it.
So the reason I called, though, is another thing.
Okay.
Those LED jumper packs, is there a chance they can kill batteries? Because I've maybe just coincident, maybe the batteries were dying anyway when I was trying to jump them, but it seems to me like there's a chance it's killing them.
You mean the lithium jumper packs?
Yes.
Okay.
Excuse me. Lithium.
I don't think so, Dave. Unless you reverse the polarity, and usually they indicate if you do that.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I would say probably the battery's just on its way out, and you were coincidental to that.
Okay. So there's nothing electronically that would cause it to do.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Okay.
Another question is battery that goes dead in an RV setting over the winter because of parasitic losses and all. I mean, that battery is just so flat dead, I can't even get a connection on it. Is there any way to bring those back?
If you had a desulfation charger, you could try that. A lot of times that'll bring them back.
It's like I put the desulfator on it and it doesn't even like light up the green light showing that there's a connection in the battery.
Yeah, that it may be a little too far. It might be too heavily sulfated. There might be too many cells that are shorted. So
Can you just dump out everything and add new acid?
No, because the problem is what happens with sulfation is crystals build up in between the plates and they short the plates out. They short them together.
Okay.
What the desulfation does is it pulses it to break down those crystals. And over time, usually at the bottom of the cells where the crystals form, those areas tend to fall apart. When it gets too old, it gets too old. If too much has happened to it, it's probably not going to come back. I have had the experience, though, just as a caveat with the charger I have, I'll desulfate it for like a day or two or three or four even, and my charger only will go up to 20 amps, and then it'll trip the breaker on the charger. So I will then switch chargers over to my Schumacher that'll just dump power into the battery, get the voltage up high enough so it's not so the desulfation charger doesn't pull 20 amps and trip the breaker. So I'm swapping chargers back and forth a lot in doing that, and I can sometimes, over the course of a week or so, get them back, but that's when it's actually still, it will take a charge. It's just drawing too much to let the 20-amp charger do it.
My desulfator is only like a little trickle charger, an amp or two.
Yeah, and that's probably part of the issue is you would need something a little bit heavier to try to get it to get it going if it would start, but I'm guessing that you're probably beyond the point of no return.
Well, I got to buy a battery charger. Do you have them that desulfate and don't desulfate?
I picked up a Chinese desulfation charger on eBay. It was $26, $28, something like that, and has Chinese print on the front of it. And I said, for 20-some bucks, I'll give it a go. And it worked for about a year, and it did desulfate. It wasn't the same as the one that I have that was mucho money, but it did a reasonable job, and for 26 bucks, it's not bad. If you can't find it, it's the front, if you look at it, is probably 3 inches tall, maybe 10 inches wide, and about 8 or 10 inches deep. And if you'll see them on eBay, obviously you want to get one from a vendor in the U.S. just to save shipping time. And they're under $30. And if you can't find it,
I paid more than that for this little trickle charger I got from Northern Tool or something.
You know, I brought my Chinese one over to the shop. I had a terminal come off. I haven't fixed it yet, and I don't know if it still works. But I'm going to mess with it when I get a break. But if you can't find it, shoot me an email, Dave, and I'll find a link for you to one of them. There's a bunch of them out there. And they also supposedly will pulse lithium batteries to bring them back. Now, lithium battery is a whole different chemistry and doesn't rejuvenate as well as lead acid. And when you're working with lithium batteries, there's always the potential of it catching on fire, which is a fun thing. But it is possible that that can be done too. So for what that's worth, it does both.
So and, would you use this like for a cordless implement that the batteries?
It would have to be batteries. Usually they're 12 or 24 volt. They'll do both voltages. So it has to be a 12 volt thing. You cordless implements a lot of times are only 3 point something. So you got to
But if you got the whole bank of them together and did it, would that be doable?
It could be possible. Again, lithium batteries are a whole different animal. They will catch on fire.
Just stick them out in the middle of the lawn when I plug it in,
or on a dry, non-combustible surface away from anything. Just to see what it does. And I would not leave it alone. I'd be monitoring it just to see what's happening.
I don't my any charge of any lithium batteries. I never leave them alone for any amount of time. Yeah. It's just
that's wise.
I've heard. I know one guy burned his house down doing that.
Yeah, that's never a good day. So
yep.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the education.
Okay. Good to talk to you. Thanks.
Yep, bye.
Yeah. I have lithium batteries. We're gonna be running our shop on a lithium pack or two, and I've been in a quandary as to where I want to place it, how I want to place it, because batteries don't want to be out in the cold in the winter. They lose capacity. But I also would prefer not to burn the building down. I'm kind of stupid that way. So we'll figure it out. I'll come up with something that works. It doesn't happen often. It really has to do usually. If there's an issue with a lithium battery catching on fire, you know, not to make them sound unsafe, it usually has to do with overcharging the battery. And that usually is related to ignorance of the charger or the person doing the charging. You just have to know what you're doing, and you have to watch, and you have to maintain the right voltage, and you can't go over it. That's the caveat I put out there. I actually picked up a charger a couple weeks ago for dealing with whole battery packs. And it does a couple things. It lets you set the maximum voltage, and it lets you also put it on a timer. It's all built in. And it still is at the mercy of what I dial in for voltage. If I dial in too much voltage, I will make things catch on fire. So it's not a real smart charger. It's relying on me to have some smarts, which could be a horrible mistake, but I will try. And I do not leave it alone. I do not leave anything alone. Lead acid batteries, I'll leave alone. Lithium batteries, nickel metal hydride batteries, I try not to leave alone because it's not worth the risk. Anyway, our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. We got the text line going, 601-207-4478. No text this morning. Can you believe that? I'm looking here yesterday, Friday morning, the text that George and Rick got. Everybody's upset about everything. Oh, my goodness. Holy mackerel. Wow. And the page just refreshed to him. Good Lord, there must be 50 texts here. I guess that's what happened when you don't talk politics. So I will continue to not talk politics and take fewer texts. Thank you. Anyway. One last thing I got here is I've been window shopping. Our new location, the office, has these old, they're insulated glass windows with an actual thermal paint on top of that. So they're really three layers of glass, but they're aluminum framed. The seals have failed on the thermal pane, so you can't see out of them, and they need to go bye-bye. So I've been shopping windows for about 4 weeks now, looking for something that I want to use. There's two of these windows, which are more like, almost like picture windows. They're kind of too big. And I don't want to go under, you know, back in the 70s, in the name of energy conservation, people used to take, you see this all over Bangor. People will take out what was a nice big window in an old house. It was a single glazed window, probably no storm windows, drafty as all get out. They took them out. You know, maybe it's a 3 foot wide by 60 inches, 5 foot tall window. And they put in a window that's maybe 30 inches by 36 inches. And it just looks stupid. And they did this in the name of energy conservation. They frame it in and they stuff some fiberglass in this 2x4 wall, which does not a whole heck of a lot of anything. And say, there, you know, we made saving energy. And the reality is it makes your house look awful and doesn't save that much energy. And it's driven me crazy over the years that if, you know, you're going to restore a house in Bangor, let's get windows that were historically accurate. We can certainly get better quality windows now and can really go back to the size they were and probably save more energy than the whole stupid scheme did way back when. So I am going to downsize the windows a bit, but I want to keep the height and a reasonable width. So been shopping windows this morning, and I'm not quite where I want to have found anything I'm happy with. Do I still have the red cape? do I still have the red cape that I flew around the insulation pile with? Boy, you've got a good memory. That was... Was that 30 years ago? No, it was 20. It had to be 25 years ago. And I did not. I do not have that cape. Was that a whole outfit? I got it from Channel 7. They had it. And I'm trying to remember the name. Well, one of the guys who was there was Tom Preble. And Tom works at a competing radio station here in town. I've known Tom forever. And I knew his father, Frank, who used to be at a savings and loan of Bangor, who gave me my mortgage for my house in Bangor. It was I walked into the bank, and this guy's there, and I thought, this is like, he struck me as a tight New England banker. And boy, this ain't going to work. I'm not getting a mortgage from this guy. And he was the most delightful man I ever dealt with in banking. He just did everything he could do to help us. And, you know, a lot of that is missing in banking. There is still some, I guess somebody on an ad calls it relationship banking. But it used to be back in the olden days, I'd walk in the bank. When I was doing, you know, I'll give you an example. We've got a couple of minutes before the break. Doing this radio show long time ago, okay? I said, okay, I want to do a TV show. And what kind of video equipment would we need? We're going to produce this ourselves. You know, like I knew what I was doing. And I found that Sony had come out with digital camcorder, $5,000. So I got to buy a camcorder. I walked into the bank, told the guy at the bank what I wanted to do, and he gave me a loan for $5,000. Just walked in the door. I knew the banker. Gave me, it wasn't Frank, it was somebody else. Same building, though. And I had that relationship with the bank. They knew me. They knew I was going to pay my bill. And that was the end of it. And that's gone because so many banks have been consolidated. There's a few that are still what I would call classical main banks. You know, Bangor Savings is one. Camden National is another. I bank with Camden National just because I found them to be more user-friendly for me. But, you know, you want to know that person, you want that person to know you. And that counts for a lot. Anyway, I could take a break here. Gosh. Oh, well, okay, we'll go here. Let's hit this one. We'll be back in a bit. It's hot and cold Saturday morning. Stay with us. We still got another hour of big radio fun coming this way. We got text messages I haven't even touched on. The text messages are coming in. Oh, it's going to be an awesome morning. That's right. Thank you, Bruce. It's hot and cold. We're back. Hour number two. It's 9:06 here at the Voice of May. My name is Tom. Good morning again. Our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. That's 1-800-966-1039. The text line 601-207-4478. We got some texts here to go through, so let's go through them in no particular order. First one is, how long does the average car battery last on the shelf? I have no idea, but if it's a new battery, probably a while. If it's a used battery, I would any battery I'd really want to keep on some kind of desulfation charger to keep it from sulfating up. They will build those crystals as they self-discharge, so it really behooves you to maintain it that way. Let's see. Where am I here? Oh, no, I got that one. Okay, what is this? Love that music. Who is that? I don't remember who I played going out. People say to me, especially I'll be on the street or something, hey, what'd you play 3 weeks ago? Remember, man, I don't remember what I played, 15 minutes ago. I'm sorry. I lost track of who I played when. That was just Bruce Springsteen now, but that isn't, you sent this email before that, a text before that. Let me see here. Yep. Okay. I remember there was a group called Cucuruza. It's a Russian bluegrass group, and the song is called the Emphysema Rag. And a lot of other folks have done it. If you look it up online, you'll find many artists. It's not a Russian bluegrass song. It's an American bluegrass song. That happened to be played by the Russians. Oh, what do I think about the plug-in electric baseboard heaters you can get, and they will be okay for would they be okay for a seasonal camp? Yeah, I mean, they're electric heaters. If you're not leaving it on while you're not there, that's the thing. A plug-in heater has the potential of, depends on how the cords are made and stuff, that it's not something you leave and just leave the building for long periods of time with it on. If you want to have an electric heater that is going to function safely, a hardwired electric baseboard should be used. And they're not expensive. I mean, they're probably no more expensive, given the capacity, than a plug-in one. But if it's just, I'm here, I want to have heat while I'm here, plug in an electric heater, that's fine. I would not leave it running while I was not in building, though. I would unplug it. So hopefully that helps. And let's see. Our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. And where we have no phone calls right now, we're going to do a new segment, which is the chronology of Leslie Gore. Because when poor Leslie passed away a couple of years ago, all her songs came back into my head, including this one. Okay, so, we all remember that. Most of us remember that song. Okay. So that was number one. Okay. Then there was this one. This is subsequent. A lot of crying in Leslie Gore's songs. But at Johnny's Comeback, okay. And then there was this one, which I've forgotten about. When she passed away, I was lamenting the fact that because whether you like those songs or not, they were so silly, and she's a good singer, I give her that, and I think she wrote them. Then she went to this one, and that's not a really good version, but the words are, "You don't own me, I'm not one of your little toys." So she has progressed. She has matured as a spurned woman, perhaps. Anyway, that ends our segment called Leslie Gore, the chronology thereof. Our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. That's 1-800-966-1039. I hope she made a lot of money on those songs, because they were, for the time, they were okay. I got no complaints about them. It has stuck in my head for, 60 years, right? 50, 60 years it's been. So that says something. That's what you call stay in power, or that's what you say Tom needs mental health assistance. what else we got here? Nothing else. I got no text. I got no phone calls. I guess I could play more Leslie Gore songs. Huh. There's a thought. That made the phone ring right there. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I was listening to your show last week. I didn't catch the end of it because I was in and out of my vehicle, but you were talking about tongue and groove boards, mm-hmm. pine boards on the ceiling. You need to put a vapor barrier?
Yes. Yeah, and okay. The reason is this. A ceiling, warm air, what does it do in a building when you're heating the room? It rises to the ceiling. So normally the barrier that would be there would be a vapor barrier. And many times that vapor barrier could just be the ceiling sheetrock. That's usually enough of a barrier to impede movement of warm, moist air out of the room up into the attic. If you put tongue and groove up on the ceiling, you now have, instead of a 4x8 sheet with joints that are mutted, you have a tongue and groove that fit together that ain't sealed and will shrink over time. So it even gets worse. And at very least, you need to have a vapor barrier there to function the way a more conventional ceiling would, like sheetrock or something like that, to try to keep warm, moist air from getting up into the attic. And with the conversation last week had to do more with that moisture getting up into the attic and freezing when it hit a cold surface and then melting when the sun came out and causing drips inside and outside the building. And the ones that I dealt with were not drips. They were flows of major amounts of water, and ice would form outside. I mean, icicles would form outside the building. It was amazing how much was moisture got up in there. But if you think about it, it's the dead of winter. It's January or something. It's just going up in there and freezing it on and on. You know, it's not quite, although it might be sunny, the roof doesn't get warm enough to melt the ice, and it just builds up over time. And then we get into maybe February, get a warm day, or we get a January thaw, and it happens, and it's a mess. So I really think if you're going to do a cathedral ceiling with V-match or Edge and Center B, whatever, something tongue and groove, the ideal is to, you could put fluffy insulation in the cavity. Ideally, you could spray foam it, which would prevent the problem, or put fluffy insulation in and put a layer of foam on the inside, usually 1 inch as a minimum, and then strap over that, seal the joints after you strap it, and then you can put Edge and Center Bead up or whatever, and it looks great and will not give you any problems.
Okay. How about in the same room, the walls? It's going to be like a small sunroom.
Yeah, a sunroom is maybe not heated the same way, so it's not quite as critical. But, if you don't want to insulate it as such, you just use a good vapor barrier. But if I was doing it, I would be doing the same deal on the walls. And if it's a new sunroom, you could put the foam on the outside of the walls before you side it if you're doing vinyl, say. Or you could do it on the inside. It could be the same routine, basically.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye. Yeah, I love using V-match. I like Edge and Center Bead. It looks historic and just attractive. And it's a little more labor to put in, but you just get a look that you can't beat. And it takes time to put it up. I remember when we did our living room, it took forever. My wife and I did it, but it was worth the effort. And I don't have to drywall. But you do have to pay attention to ceiling properly. All right, we're going to take a break here. It is, I'm going to lose the Leslie Gore. I know, you wanted more Leslie Gore, but that's okay. We'll go here. When we come back, we'll take your phone calls at 1-800-966-1039. It's hot and cold. Hey, we're back. It's 919 here at the Voice of Maine. It's hot and cold Saturday morning. Good morning again. Our phone number is 1-800-966-1039. That's 1-800-966-1039. We got a text line, 601-207-4478, and we've got a phone call there. I do that. We do this. We turn down the music. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Hey, good morning.
Hey.
I'm off grid. I've got about a four kilowatt converter.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of adding my banks as I increase my load.
Sure.
But for the size of my house, that 4 kilowatt would be fine.
Eventually.
But right now, I just noticed that some of the batteries, and I'm just using some of those golf cart batteries.
Yep.
That I've got some, and these are, you know, a couple of years old.
Yep.
But they're, they've got like a gray powdery residue in the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when I do my equalization,
yep.
I do a monthly equalization, it looks a little murky, but then if I go to test it with my hydrometer and then, you know, squirt it back down inside, it's just this gray, like I said, just gray residue.
Yep. I think that's called aging.
Yeah, but I mean, what is it? I mean, is that itself?
I believe that's the plates flaking off over time, and you know, as the batteries age.
Well, it seemed awfully light. It was very easy to hold it in suspension,
mm-hmm.
and I thought if it was going to be lead, it would be. And I've seen sulfated plates before, and it doesn't look like that.
Okay,
you know, it doesn't look like sulfation residue.
Oh, maybe somebody can comment more intelligently than I, but I'm pretty sure it's just the plates breaking down. And it may be lead sulfate flakes. I'm not into the chemistry of lead acid batteries that much, but you know, golf cart batteries are a little different. They're not quite the same as what would be normally used for an off-grid system. Usually there's a little bit more substantial battery with a heavier plate, but I mean, it's fine as long as they're working. It sounds like you're doing everything right in terms of maintaining them. So I would just.
Yeah, well, I got them set up as a 24 volt system,
mm-hmm.
and you know, they're 6 volt batteries, so I got them in series parallel.
Sure.
And they don't use a particular amount of water. I mean, you know, you could touch it up every so often.
Yeah.
Bring them up to the ring.
How many batteries do you have?
Right now, just 8.
Okay. Yeah, that.
No, just a small. I mean, I don't use much power.
Okay.
And.
So you got roughly about 10 kilowatts of capacity there. I think I'm doing my math right in my head.
Not much. I mean, yeah. I got a freezer, and the freezer, believe it or not, doesn't draw anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
My computer and it's a small Mac. My computer and the few lights that I run are almost as much of a draw as the freezer.
So let me ask you a question. Do you wind up running out of power where you have to use a backup system? I'm just curious.
Well,
I have no specific reason for asking.
No, I don't. That is my... Oh, I mean, I have to turn on the generator because I'm off-grid, so...
Well, that's what I'm asking. You're running off PVs, though, so how often do you have to run the backup?
I would run the battery, I mean, I run the generator about once a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just got a refrigerator that used 330, it's a small, it's like a 10-cubic-foot refrigerator.
Mm.
And it was rated at 330 kilowatts a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that almost necessitated that I had to go to run it almost maybe 1.5 times a day.
Are you seeing I guess I'm wondering if you need more storage capacity, because 4 kilowatts is a pretty reasonably sized system. Although that sounds you know, 10 kilowatts of capacity is probably about where you should be.
Well, I have a Honda 3000,
mm-hmm.
You know, the one with the inverter.
Yep.
And anyway, that's what I started with before I even did batteries or the inverter.
Sure.
Let's see. And that puts out, I guess, 28 amps at the max. But this thing, I just run it off a 15-amp circuit, and it never blows. It never shuts itself off with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, only if I'm doing a piece of equipment. So it's a very... It doesn't take anything to charge it. It doesn't burn any gas hardly.
Mm.
and it's never running. You know, when you put it on that eco throttle, if you're familiar with that model.
I'm not, but that's okay.
They have an eco model, so it just since it's an inverter, it'll just drop it down to the lowest RPM that it needs to run.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually just drops down to an island. You can't even hear the thing practically.
Yeah.
So even running at that, I'm not even anywhere near. When I'm equalizing it, it'll take it up over, you know, like 30 amps or something. I mean 30 volts.
Sure.
And it'll just increase the RPM accordingly. But most of the time, I'm running the generator. It's just sitting there at idle.
Mm.
You know, charging the battery.
Interesting. Good. All right. I think
the inverter and the generator are reasonably sized.
Yep.
And the batteries, like right now, I can see that if I've only got 8 batteries, I probably need 12 or 16.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I want to invest in those batteries again if they're going to start prematurely.
Yeah.
You know, flaking.
I would advise a better quality battery. They're easy to get, and you know they do the job for now, but usually there's a market out there for used telecom batteries. You know, for these places where you have cell towers, they have a backup system in place, which are really deep cycle batteries, and they change them out on a schedule. Obviously, mm-hmm. they take very good care of their batteries because they don't want a failure. And I have a friend who does this work a lot in terms of getting these batteries that come off service but are very high quality and very high capacity.
Probably very high.
And they're heavy as hell. They're heavy as hell. But more lead is better when it comes to batteries. And they'll last a long time. As a matter of fact, years ago when Maine Yankee closed, nobody wanted to mess with those batteries. He got them. They had huge, I think there were 2,000 or 4,000 amp hour, 2-volt cells in huge glass containers. And he recycled them, and there's people in the area who use them for their off-grid systems. They never have to replace the stupid things. They're huge.
does it have a company name or a...
If you want to call me during the week, I work with him, in full disclosure. And he is right now, he works with a recycling company, so we get them in on a regular basis. I can give you his number. I know he's not in town right now, but I can give it to you off the
air. You're in Searsport, right?
Yeah, I'm in Searsport. I'll give my number when we when we're done with our conversation. And then you can call me during the week, and I can put you in touch with him. He is out of state right now, but he'll be back. And I know he had some come in that were fairly substantial, that were quite reasonable. And the lead acids never last because we get in lithiums too, but the lead acids never last because they all go to off-grid systems because they're a couple steps beyond what you should have, you know, what you have as a golf cart battery.
Yeah. So. Well, what's the optimum? I think I've asked a few people, and they said, well, if you just keep your, make it so that after you charge it, if you only run it down to 24.4 volts, on a 24-volt system, he said those things will last forever, but they don't.
Yeah, Well, again, they're not designed for this kind of use, and they're right. Uh-huh. You don't want to run them down too low. Lead acid batteries do not like that. But you know, to get you off the ground and get you started, it's a cheap date, and obviously they work. And you're doing everything I think you should do right now to keep them maintained and keep the system functioning properly. So when the time comes that you need to replace them, I can put you in touch with my friend and see what he has. They come and go, but he usually has something kicking around. Of course, whenever I need them, they're never there. But he had some lead acid batteries that would fit in the Prius for the 12-volt battery. And of course, I got the last one. There was one left. I got it. He had, I think, 100 of them, and those were brand new. And excuse me, I want to say they were 50 amp hour batteries. And they were again for a telecom type application. They were petite for what you would be doing, but for a Prius, they were perfect. But he had 100 amp hour ones that were 12 volt, and they were heavy as death. This one is heavy, the 50 amp hour. I mean, it's a little bit overkill for a car that's supposed to be lightweight, but, you know, they fit.
Well, so, these things are like 75 pounds a piece.
Yeah, yep. And that's light for these kind of systems. I know he had some come in that I want to say 195 amp hour, 12 volt batteries, and it was all I could do just to grab it. I wasn't picking it up very much. It was heavy.
Yeah.
Very heavy. Anyway, I got to let you go. We got a break coming up. Good luck.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
How are you doing the week?
Okay, bye-bye. Okay. And I'll give you our phone number for those of you out in Radio Land. It's 888-866-8970. I don't do any, the only reason I'm running interference for him is because he's not in town right now. And he would probably prefer if I didn't give his phone number out over the radio. Let's see. Let's go here. This is a good one. When we come back, we'll take more phone calls at 1-800-966-1039. It's hot and cold Saturday morning. Okay, we're back. 9:37. It's hot and cold on Saturday morning. Good morning again. I'm Tom. Phone number is 1-800-966-1039. The text line 601-207-4478. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling from up to Springfield. I live off the grid. And that gentleman that just called about the solar panels, I just wanted to give him a heads up on the batteries. My solar setup isn't like his. I have the individual kits from Harbor Freight and a battery hooked up to each kit. And they're about 110 amp batteries. I have a battery from October of 2012. The key is don't take it below, you know, 50-55%. And they're on the south side of my home. They're all in their individual, setups, you know, so that the snow coming off the roof doesn't hit them.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep them at the winter angle because I have, you know, a number of them. And they charge very well because I have a number of them. And in the evening when I go to watch TV, I just take one of the batteries and put them, they're each on their little dolly, put it behind my TV, and I get anywhere from 3 to 4.5 hours of TV. The difference but the thing was the bigger batteries, and if you don't let them run down, they last 3, 4, 5 years with no problem.
Yep.
And hold a very good charge. But I have propane for my big refrigerator and my cook stove. And 100-pound tank lasts 2 months and another extra 40 pounds during canning season.
Mm-hmm.
So a setup, you know, maybe you might want to consider something, you know, a bigger battery. They're just the boat batteries, the marine batteries from Walmart.
Yep.
And they're worth the investment. But once you run them down to 10%, you may as well just go get another one.
Right.
Because it all but kills them.
Yep.
So, but that was just my piece of advice for the guy. But the way it's set up, from basically right after the Super Bowl until football season, mid-September, I don't run my generator at all to charge a battery. Okay. They run that well, you know, and they hold a charge very well. So maybe that might be a little bit for the gentleman that was just on, he might want to think about.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. You know, maintaining the battery and lead acid batteries do not like to be discharged low because it shortens their lifespan significantly. But also, if you have a big system, this guy had a big system, you need a good capacity battery, and your step beyond golf cart and your step beyond marine batteries, it's a whole other genre of battery there that's significant and of value. And a good solar battery will last 15, 20 years if it's maintained, and it doesn't take much to maintain them. So, but the threshold for getting into batteries to start out using a golf cart or a marine cycle battery is low. They're cheap. And that correlates to less longevity. So anyway, thank you for your call. Back to the phones. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Hi.
Hi.
Is it Tom?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. I heard you talking. I have a camp that was built around 1920.
Mm-hmm.
And years ago, It's got a cathedral ceiling. There is no attic. The upstairs bedrooms is the ceiling.
Okay.
And it was all open studs, and we just put in like 6-inch fiberglass insulation and put up shiplap, face nailed it,
mm-hmm.
and put flat urethane on it.
Yep.
We have now gotten some mildew in the peak of that ceiling.
Yep.
And I've heard you talking about this, and I know it's not inadequate. Also, I had to put, I've now come up in the winter a few times,
mm-hmm.
and I got terrible ice dams.
Yep.
On the one side of the house, so I had to put up the heat cables up on the roof.
Yep.
What's the best way to correct that?
Well, there's a couple of ways. That probably the simplest and best would be to if you have to re-roof, is to get some foam up on the roof. And here's the way I would do this. If this was my building, I would put I'm assuming you have shingles on the roof now.
Right, there are shingles, and I think it's just like sheathing boards under it.
That's fine.
Not the plywood.
That doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
Right.
So in that case, I would you have to strip off the old shingles, mm-hmm. put down a layer of foam. I would say, considering maybe someday you're using it a little more in the winter, I would probably be around 3 inches of foam. And as I'm putting the foam on, excuse me, and I've done this, I start working at the eave, and I strap horizontally every 2 feet going up the roof. And I'm screwing through the foam, through the strapping, through the foam into, in this case, your sheathing boards. And I would then put a metal roof on top of this. And you know, screw down metal roof. You screw into your strapping. And you know where the strapping is. It's easy to do. And you can work your way up the roof as you're installing the foam and the strapping. Then once that's done, you've got the horizontal strapping that you can kind of hang off of doing the roof, so it isn't as quite as hairy as it would be if you didn't have the strapping there, because that's kind of like a ladder laying on the roof for you.
Right.
And it works well. Now, what you've done in the process here is a couple things. You've added insulation to the roof, which is root cause of the issue. What's happening is that warm air that's in the building when you are occupying it, or if it's a sunny day, any moisture in there finds its way to that peak, and you're getting this mildew because that's the cold surface, and that's the high point of the building,
right.
And it's not heated. So once you insulate now on the outside, you've kept that surface inside warmer.
Correct. And
so that will make a big difference. I would also be maybe to get this working properly, I'd remove or work my – if I could work my way in to block off the fiberglass that's in the lowest edge of the roof with foam. In other words, push the fiberglass up and put whatever the thickness is, let's say 6 inches, 5.5, 6 inches of foam up a foot or two. So you're blocking any airflow that would sneak into that fiberglass from the outside. Before you apply the foam, you know, put the sheathing board back on and apply the foam, it makes a big difference. And I would foam all the joints. I would be making sure that we're trying to make this area where the fiberglass is tight from the outside.
So let me get that. So you would take 5 or 6 inches of rigid foam.
Right.
You would then.
I would fill that cap. I filled the attic, the cavity that currently has fiberglass in it.
Mm-hmm.
With foam up maybe a foot or two.
Just a foot or two.
Just to protect the, to keep air from getting up into the fiberglass now, because you just got boards there. It's going to be a little bit on the drafty side. I would seal that with canned foam, put the sheathing board back down, and then work my way up the roof. And, mm-hmm. you know, what we're trying to do is keep air from getting into the fluffy insulation that should be protected from air movement.
Okay, now, and then one other, the simple question.
Mm-hmm.
The mildew that's on that ceiling.
Yeah.
I did back a ways get up there and scrub it with bleach or something, but yep. it didn't totally go away, but it's come back some.
Well, there's a simpler material to use. It's called Moldex. They sell it at Home Depot in gallon jugs, and you just spray it. And you just wet it down the surface and leave it there, and it will kill the mildew.
Okay. All right.
And it is safe.
It seems like it got inside the urethane, it looked like to me.
It could be. You might have to refinish it, but for the time being, you could just hit it with the Moldex to kill anything that's growing up there.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
And that would be the way to go, do it from the outside, rather than try to rip that. The ceiling's all face-nailed.
If you wanted to rip the ceiling out and do it from the inside, fill the cavity. From the inside, you just put a layer of foam on the ceiling before you reapplied whatever you want to have for a ceiling. You could leave the fiberglass that's there, and the foam now becomes a vapor barrier and another thermal break. It may be simpler for you if you're getting close to re-roofing to do it on the outside.
Yeah, it's about 20 years old, the shingles.
Yeah.
But the foam, if you did it from the inside, you would just screw the foam onto the joist.
Right. I'd face nail it to the joist. I would probably use either somewhere between 1 and 2 inch foam. And, you know, it's a question of how much headroom can you afford to lose. I would strap it with 3/4 inch strapping, and then I would reapply. Because with the strapping, you can screw through into your rafters, and then you've got that nice nailing surface for reapplying your wood if that's what you want to put back up.
Strappings are like 1x3s.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, look, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Love your show.
Thanks. Bye bye.
Okay,
okay. So we got a couple of text messages here. Where am I? Wondering if you could go over how an old brick home should function and techniques to upgrade wall insulation for efficiency if possible. It's a tough one. I love old brick homes. If I have exposed brick on the inside, to put it bluntly, your world sucks. It's conductive. If you want to keep the brick look. If you don't want to keep the brick look, then I would be foaming on the inside and strapping over the foam and putting a new finished wall on the inside. If you want to keep the brick, and I would want to keep the brick, then life gets challenging. There's no easy way to insulate that. It's possible there is a cavity in between the inner and outer surface of the brick wall. The catch is it's probably irregular. You can get foam into that. There's a pourable foam that you can pour into the cavity. The catch here is if you try to put foam insulation, pourable, any kind of liquid foam that's going to become solid, in a cavity, especially a rigid cavity or any cavity, it's going to expand and potentially cause damage to the walls. That being said, there are foams that do not expand rapidly, so they will fill the cavity without pushing the walls out. And the folks who do this, there are people who do it, foam applicators. You want to know for sure they have done this more than once. You don't want to be the first one because there's the opportunity there to cause a lot of damage to the structure. But that's the only way to do it, short of covering the inside or the outside of the building with insulation and losing that aesthetic that you may otherwise love. I would. I've avoided brick buildings my whole life just because they're a tough nut to insulate. But thermally, if you want to do it the absolute best way, you wrap the outside of the brick building with foam, you side it, and you got that thermal break, and you've got a tremendous amount of thermal mass. All this brick construction will now function very well just as a passive solar structure because it's going to heat up when it's warm out and hold that heat for a very long time. Likewise, it'll cool down when it's warm out if you're conditioning the space and hold that temperature for a very long time if it's insulated on the outside. But then you lose the brick look. And isn't that what it's all about? So that's a tough one. So I hope that helps. It's not an easy one. Who doesn't love an old brick building? Well, let's see. We got a long one here. Tom, our friends purchased a property on the lake, originally built for seasonal use, experiencing frozen septic line this winter. frozen section was located after the septic pump from the tank to the leach field. Would you recommend digging it up and insulating the ground pipe, or do you have experience with heat line retro DWS system? Internal self-lubricating heat cable. Which would you suggest? Excuse me. Good question. If it depends on the situation, and I'm challenged here just working off a text message, but if the pipe is down in the ground, and obviously there's some logistics that you can't be down too far, but you let's say you've got 2 feet of soil over the pipe, and you want to bump that up, you want to protect the pipe from freezing, I would be doing this. I would dig down to the pipe. I would then backfill 6 inches of soil over the pipe, and then I would have an inch of styrofoam for every foot of depth that I'm missing. So if I'm only down 2 feet, I would probably have 4 inches of styrofoam over top of that. And I would go 4 feet, so 2 feet on either side of the pipe, to try to keep frost from getting into that pipe. I also put the heat tape on it. It's a belt and suspenders deal, because you do not want it to freeze again. And the heat tape, you could potentially even leave unplugged and just use it when you think there's a potential problem. And the other thing you could do is it's cheap enough to buy an inexpensive temperature sensor, a little electronic thing with a remote sensor, where you could put the sensor on the pipe and monitor the surface temperature of the pipe in, you know, the area where it froze. I suspect if you just add the insulation, an inch of thickness of styrofoam is equivalent to a foot of depth. So that's the rule of thumb, works reasonably well. I would go over that. So if we want to be down 5 feet, I'd have an extra foot of depth equivalent there to try to make sure there's not a problem. And I would be at least 2 feet on either side of the pipe, so we don't have freezing coming in underneath the pipe around the edges of the foam. You know, the cheap date is just to put a piece of 2-foot wide foam over the pipe. You're only spanning 1 foot on either side. It depends on the soils. If the soils are rough in that they're wetter soils, there's more potential there for freezing underneath the insulation, and then party's over. Now, a little bit of insulation does go a long way, because you do have heated water going out of this pipe. So if we can keep the frost from getting down in there and taking the heat out, we're going to be okay. But I'm guessing here from that I would have at least 4 inches of insulation, and that's not that much. It depends how long a run is. You didn't say how long the run is, but that's where that would be the whether it's really expensive, it's a cheap date. But the heat tape, you don't want to dig it up again. It depends on the cost of the heat tape again and the length. If it isn't that far a run, I'd have the heat tape on it too, and maybe hopefully never need it. But also remember, it is important to have 6 inches of soil over top of the pipe before the insulation, and that's just to add some extra mass to help keep it from freezing. So hopefully that does the trick for you. This is going to be a quick one, because we're almost out of time. Good morning. You're on the Voice of Maine.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I'm in the process of remodeling a bathroom. I noticed below the subflooring on the timbers, and of course it's a crawl space down below, I got some mold going. Do you have any suggestions on how to remove that and maybe treat the timbers?
Yeah.
Take the answer offline.
Thank you. Appreciate your call. The Moldex is a great product. Moldex, M-O-L-D, mold, E-X, all one word. They sell it at Home Depot. It's relatively inexpensive. It is safe. It is not toxic. It takes care of mold. You just spray it on the surface and leave it and let it dry. You don't have to do anything else. The company that makes Moldex, you can look them up on the label. They do make a preventative as well. It is a preventative when you use it in the application I just described, but that will it'll work for a while. I'm sure over time it might wear away. Where you have a crawl space, get some plastic down on the ground For two reasons. One, it cuts the moisture from coming up and hitting that floor surface and causing the mold. And also, if you're crawling around down there, you're crawling on plastic now instead of dirt and God knows what. So hopefully that helps. And let's see, if we go to Mr. Francis Albert here, we can end the program, put the program out of its misery till next week when we'll come back like Lazarus. Take care.